This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Francis Gary Powers was a CIA U-2 pilot shot down in 1960 while flying a reconnaissance mission over the Soviet Union. He was held in a Soviet prison for almost 2 years before being exchanged for a senior KGB agent who'd been captured in the United States. The incident exposed America's secret reconnaissance missions, and President Eisenhower was forced to admit to aerial spying. While in prison, Powers kept a journal, and he was allowed to write and receive letters. His son, Francis Gary Powers Jr., has compiled these, along with family photos, in the book Letters from a Soviet Prison, the personal journal and correspondence of CIA U-2 pilot Francis Gary Powers. On Friday, he'll be giving a lecture, The U-2 Incident, A Son's Search for the Truth, at the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force near Dayton. Francis Gary Powers Jr. joins us along with the Air Force Museum's historian, Dr. Doug Lantry. And we won't be able to take any calls during this segment, but you can still send your questions and comments in. Email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Gary and Doug, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, you're welcome. Happy to help out.
Same here. Thanks for having us on.
Gary, for those who may not be familiar with your father's story, tell us about that mission he was on when he was shot down on May 1st, 1960.
Well, my father was one of about a dozen U-2 pilots, CIA pilots recruited in the 1950s to overfly the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, and other countries to take photographic reconnaissance imagery. On May 1st, 1960, my father was tasked to fly the May 1st mission, trying to get information back out of the Soviet Union on SA-2 missile bases that were being developed and other targets. He was shot down near the city of Sverdlovsk on May 1st, 1960. As a result, he was caught, captured, imprisoned, interrogated. A show trial took place, basically trying to embarrass the United States through my father, and he was sentenced to 10 years in prison. As a result of the U-2 incident, as you said in your introduction, Eisenhower had to admit that we had overhead reconnaissance platforms and that we had been spying on the Soviet Union with U-2s the last 5 years. In addition, Khrushchev, the premier of the Soviet Union at the time, ended up banging his shoe at the UN as a result of the U-2 incident a few months later.
So he was furious over this, Khrushchev.
That's correct. He was very upset that Eisenhower would authorize these flights personally. So for Khrushchev, it was an insult, but Eisenhower justified it as a vital but distasteful necessity in order to avert another Pearl Harbor.
You know, it's interesting, Gary, that the preface to the book, Letters from a Soviet Prison, that was written by Khrushchev's son, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Sergei Khrushchev is the son of Premier Khrushchev. He is a professor emeritus at Brown University. He and I have known each other since 1996. I am humbled to call him a friend. We have talked about Cold War history, our parents' involvement, what his views are, what my views are. Sometimes we agree, sometimes we disagree, but we go forward as friends.
Tell me about your father. What kind of a person was he?
Well, my father was a Virginia gentleman, I like to say. He was born and raised in Southwest Virginia during the midst of the Depression. He was the first of his family to go to college, graduated from Milligan College in 1950, and immediately enlisted in the U.S. Air Force. He always wanted to fly. From the very beginning, when he was about 10, 11 years old, he got that bug. He had a ride in a biplane at some country fair in Southwest Virginia, and he came down, and he knew that he was going to be a pilot, and he pursued that dream. He ended up enlisting in 1950 after college. He flew F-84s until 1955 when he was recruited by the CIA, and then between 55 and 60, he flew the U-2 for the CIA U-2 program.
Doug, what's the relevance of a story like this today, of the story of Francis Gary Powers and the history of the Cold War? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the relevance of a story like this today is that, first of all, it serves as connective tissue between the past and the present. It's an interesting and complex reminder that geopolitical rivalries survive, and that they have baggage and backgrounds, and it's instructive for parsing out the way people think today, what their priorities are, why nations do what they do, and what they want. Looking back to stories like this one can give us some good insight into attitudes today, and thereby, you know, provide us with some pointers on what we should do next.
And Gary, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, the people say the Cold War ended in 1991. I mean, that's where most historians have it ending. I've heard you talk about, I think it's Cold War 2.0 that's going on today. that really, it's just taken a new form.
Correct. The Cold War, in the traditional sense, between the Soviets and the United States, is over. I mean, there's no more Soviet Union. Hence, there's no more superpower that we would have a conflict with, per se. Today's Cold War, which I call 2.0, there's saber-rattling. There are threats. There is, like, the dispute in the South China Sea, the dispute with Putin, Crimea. This is the new Cold War that has taken place between these nations that have always been, quote-unquote, hostile to our interests, but it's not between two superpowers per se. It's between other countries that were coming into their own now.
Now, the 2015 Steven Spielberg movie Bridge of Spies depicts the whole effort to win your father's release in exchange for the U.S. releasing convicted Soviet spy Rudolf Abel. Were you an advisor for that movie, and how accurate did that movie turn out to be?
Well, yes, Mark, I was a consultant on the movie. It was an honor and a privilege to be able to work with Spielberg and Hanks and Austin Stoll, the actor who portrayed my father. It was a delight to work with these people. In regards to the movie, the Powers family is very happy of the outcome. The movie in the big picture is historically accurate. It accurately portrays the time period of the Cold War, the U-2 incident, the tensions between the Soviets and the Americans, and what was going on during this time period. Very well portrayed. The details of every scene, it is Hollywood.
Yeah.
There is embellishment. There is dramatic effect. There's artistic liberty. So while the big picture is historically accurate, the details of every scene are not.
Now, the Soviets held your father for 22 months, is that right?
Approximately, yes.
About 22 months. How was he treated when they held him in that Soviet prison?
He was treated rather well, all things considered. There was no physical torture, which, you know, is a godsend. But there was mental deprivation, sleep deprivation, isolation, different tactics to try to break him and get him to cooperate, short of physical abuse.
So just a lot of mental pressure was put on him.
Correct.
Did he ever divulge anything?
Not that they didn't already know. The first week, he was lying to his interrogators outright, holding back as much information as possible. But then the front page headlines start to appear. The KGB guard in charge rushes into the cell, yells at him, shoves a newspaper in my dad's face, says, basically, "You've lied to us. You told us you were trained in Arizona. Well, the New York Times says you're trained in Nevada at Area 51. You might as well tell us everything. We'll get it out of your American press anyways." So all of a sudden, my dad's stuck between a rock and a hard place. And for the next 2.5 months, 3 months of interrogations, he does the following. He tells the full truth when he knows they can verify the information in the press. Helps to give him credibility. Lies to him outright when he knows there's no way they can get the answer, the information that they're trying to get. And the third thing he was trying to do was he did a part truth, a part lie, danced around the subject when he knew that they knew something about the question they were asking, but not enough to contradict his answer.
Now, when they were training him for these missions, did they train him in these techniques on how to tiptoe right up to the line, almost the truth, not quite the truth? Were they teaching them these techniques?
No.
He just figured this out.
He figured this out on his own, yes. And then when he returned home and was debriefed, he worked for the CIA for about another 6 months and would train agents on what to do if captured, how to go through interrogations, how to appear to cooperate when, in fact, you're not providing any information. But the early U-2 pilots, they all came from the military service, and they had escape and evasion training through the military, but they never did any training on what to do if captured. And one of the things my father asked during the briefing was, hey, you know, what happens if one of us goes down? It just happened to be my dad that asked this. And his response was to him was, "You might as well tell them everything. They'll get it out of you anyways," because they thought that once captured, the pilots would be tortured.
Doug, tell us a little bit about the tone at the time. This is the Cold War, right? This is probably the height of the Cold War. Is that right to say?
Well, yes. You could say it was just before the most tense period of the Cold War, which surrounded the Cuban Missile Crisis. But at this point, recall that Khrushchev and Eisenhower were edging towards cooperation. Khrushchev visited the United States and met farmers and so on, and had in turn invited Eisenhower to bring his family and grandchildren to the Soviet Union to see what that country was about. And so they were edging toward cooperation. At the same time, the United States knew that information was hard to come by about the Soviet Union. The Iron Curtain was really was a real thing. It was very, very hard to get information about your rivals. So on the one hand, we're edging toward cooperation. And on the other hand, Eisenhower is getting pressure to build up bombers, build up missiles, with the public perception of a bomber gap and a missile gap, worries that we're falling behind the Soviet Union in all sorts of technological and weapons system ways. So a tool like the U-2 became very valuable in letting Eisenhower resist the pressure to build up weapon systems faster and in a more unnecessary way than he actually had to. So it was useful that way, but the tensions, to get back to the tension part, the events of May 1960 destroyed a summit conference that was scheduled right after that, and that was where Gary had mentioned Khrushchev banging his shoe. He demanded to be the first speaker, and he unleashed a fiery denunciation of the U.S. And because the Soviets released information very, very slowly, a little piece at a time, about whether or not the pilot was alive and whether or not they had the airplane, it completely destroyed President Eisenhower's cover story for what this plane was up to. And so what had been edging toward cooperation became a real destruction of relations, at least temporarily.
Gary, your father was allowed to keep a journal and send letters while he was in prison. You published those in the book Letters from a Soviet Prison. What are some of the things he was writing about? Can you give us some examples of what he was writing about?
I have the book in front of me.
Okay.
And basically, he was writing in his journal. He wanted to keep a detailed record of what was going on so he wouldn't forget. And he was encouraged to write this journal by his cellmate, Zergard Krimich, a Latvian who was his cellmate in Vladimir prison. So on or about, I think, October, November of 1960, so May, June, July, August, and October, about 5-6 months after the shoot down and about 3 months after the trial, he starts keeping a detailed journal. He starts off by recounting what took place with the U-2 incident and what led up to it. I'm going to read here just a quick segment that clarifies exactly what caused the U-2 to be shot down. Let's see, where does it start here? Also during this time, I was much relieved by not seeing any condensation trails. I thought they did not have radar contact with me and were not trying for an intercept. At least I was hoping that they had no radar contact. It was during this time that I was feeling fairly good. I was on course, the aircraft was working good with the exception of the autopilot, and the weather was clear and the navigation was fairly easy. I had been in clear weather for 30 minutes. I had just made a turn in a northwesterly direction, and I could see the city of Sverdlovsk up ahead. My route was just southwest of the city. After rolling out straight and level and lining up on course, I was checking my engine instruments, oxygen, etc. It was approximately 1 minute after the turn, and at most 2 minutes, when I suddenly felt and heard a dull explosion. It was not a bang or a loud noise, but sounded like a whoomph. Everything seemed to stand still for a long time. It seemed as if time had stopped. It couldn't have been more than a second, but it seemed to me at least 5 minutes. I remember saying to myself, maybe out loud, I'm not sure, good Lord, I've had it now. I was beginning to feel better because nothing happened, and then the right wing dropped. I picked it up with the controls, and then the nose started to go down. I pulled the control column back, and there was no resistance to the movement. That was when I knew something was bad wrong. The nose kept going down, and there was nothing I can do to stop it. Suddenly, the plane tumbled, nose down, and it was here that I think I lost both wings. It's hard for me to say what happened because it happened so fast. There were several violent maneuvers, which are impossible for me to describe. In a few seconds, the plane, or what was left of it with me, started spinning in an upside-down position with the nose pointing towards the sky. My suit also inflated at this time. I did not feel it inflate. Just all at once, I realized that it was squeezing me. The spin was causing about 3 to 4 G-forces. I was being forced toward the nose of the aircraft and also towards the top of the cabin. I knew I had to get out as soon as possible. So that's just the first part of his journal that he kept. And in addition to the journal that he wrote in, he also was able to write letters to his family, his mom, his dad, his wife, and his siblings. And he was able to receive letters in from them and other well-wishers. So fortunately, my dad and mom kept all these correspondence. I have gathered them together, and over the last, 20 years, I have data entered them into my computer. And finally, I felt it was the appropriate time to publish these letters, first time they've ever been published, to give a first-hand, detailed account of what my father went through, the U-2 incident, the truth behind what took place. And when I started my research to learn more about my father, I did not start with the idea to vindicate him. I started doing my research initially back 20, 25 years ago to find out the truth so I knew how to answer questions. And all of a sudden, it just continued to snowball. I would find out some information, and it would lead to new questions that would lead to new more information that would lead to new questions, and it just became bigger and bigger. And so I thought that an appropriate thing to do was to publish his correspondence. That way people could read from the horse's mouth exactly what took place. It would help dispel the conspiracy theories. It would help to set the record straight. And it would be my father's written account of what took place both before the shoot-down, during the shoot-down, during his imprisonment, and what happened on his return home.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit more, about how he was treated and how he was perceived when he got back home.
Well, in the midst of the Cold War, we're coming off McCarthyism, McCarthy era of the 1950s, and the blacklists, and the Red Scare, and the Red Menace, and all these things of the 50s. And May 1st, 1960s, what, 5 months in the 1960s. And so we were fearful that there were spies everywhere in America, and that the Soviets were going to bury us, as Khrushchev said. So when my father was shot down, because of the misinformation of the time and people talking, thinking they knew what they were talking about, trying to find out or acknowledge what took place, not really knowing, they thought it was a flame out. They thought my father had defected. They thought he landed the plane intact. They thought he spilled his guts and told the Soviets everything he knew. So fake news that we have today is nothing new. Misinformation was fake news back in the 50s and 60s. And this, to the detriment of my father, tarnished his reputation for many years because people thought it was his fault that the plane went down, that he cooperated with the enemy, that he ended up embarrassing a president. So it took some 50 years for the U.S. Air Force and the CIA to set the record straight. The Powers family is very honored and very humbled to know that the Air Force and the CIA have both acknowledged my father as a hero to our country and have posthumously awarded him some medals, including the Silver Star. So it's come full circle. And like I like to say during my lectures, it's never too late to set the record straight.
What happened to your father? He died in 1977? Is that right?
Yes. He went on to be a U-2 test pilot for Lockheed between 1963 and 1970. He went on to write a book called Operation Overflight about his experiences. He then went to work for radio and television stations in the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles, and he flew between 1972 and 1977 for KGIL radio station, as well as NBC, KNBC television, out in Los Angeles. Then August 1st, 1977, helicopter crashes, runs out of gas. he and the cameraman are killed in the crash.
So, Gary, real quickly in the last 30 seconds, what message would you like today's generation to get from your father's story?
I would like to let the future generations know about this Cold War and how it has transitioned into the War on Terror. And what Doug has said, had said right in the intro, in the opening, in regards to history, kind of is always changing. It's morphing. It's history yesterday, but it's the future tomorrow. You have to learn from what took place in the Cold War. You have to understand these tensions and these various countries and political players that were instrumental in the Cold War time period to understand the world today. And it's very important that kids and future generations understand that these links on the War on Terror have a direct connection to the Cold War. The one example I'll give is Osama bin Laden. We all know about him, 9/11, etc.
And I apologize, but as quickly as you can, Gary.
Oh, sure. But back in the 1979-1980 era, Afghan War, Soviet Union invades Afghanistan, CIA ends up training Osama bin Laden to fight against the Soviet Army, and then he uses that training against us. There's the connection to the Cold War and the War on Terror.
Gary and Doug, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're most welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. I'll look forward to seeing you, Doug, in a couple days.
Okay, see you, Gary.
Gary Parer's book is Letters from a Soviet Prison, the personal journal and correspondence of CIA U-2 pilot Francis Gary Powers. On Friday, he'll be giving a lecture, The U-2 Incident, A Sun's Search for the Truth, at the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force. You can find a link to more information at WVXU.org. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.